So, Mr. President Trump yesterday made an announcement that they're going to keep the, what is it? They got about 200,000 Bitcoin?
Is that right? No, it's more than that, isn't it?
I mean, they have around 200,000, but over half of it belongs to Bitfinex.
Yeah, that's the point. So they've got bring the mic in closer to you.
Yeah.
They've got I heard 1% of the supply, and then somebody tweeted, but hold on a second. Like half of that is Bitfinex.
I think Jameson tweeted that.
Yeah.
Oh, was that your tweet I saw?
I did put that out there, yes.
Yeah, that must have been it then. Okay, can we walk back a couple of steps? Mm. If we know that it's Bitfinex's, because I remember reading and assumed they'd... I remember reading that it'd been recovered. I assumed mm-hmm. Bitfinex had it transferred back to them.
Bitfinex would certainly like for it to be transferred back to them. Now, I know I asked Paolo about this a year ago, and he was like cautiously optimistic that they would eventually get it back. But I think the federal government is not going to make it easy. I don't know of any like specific legal motions that have or have not been filed with regard to it. But another thing is that technically that whole case is still lingering.
Right. Okay. Where do I even start with this? Do I start with my conspiracy hat on? Okay. So there was a hack.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, and Bitfinex made everyone buy whole. They did a token, right?
Correct.
They did a token. They actually, and everyone got made whole. Based on the performance of the exchange, they would buy back the token or burn the token.
It was complicated, right? And it depended on what jurisdiction you were in. I think people generally not in America had some options to get Bitfinex equity. Other people were given this recovery token, which then traded freely on the market for a couple of years until the point at which they offered to completely, you know, buy back one-to-one and give people the Bitcoin.
But it was actually seen as a good token, wasn't it? And it was a well...
I would say it was one of the best executed token launches of all time.
Because people got their money back.
Yes.
Which is great. So, okay. And then, but the cost of Bitfinex was the cost of operating the token and paying people back. But they made everyone whole again.
Yeah.
How many Bitcoin were hacked from them?
It was 119,756, I believe.
Okay, so that's like 0.5% of the supply.
That's a lot.
Of Bitcoin. Okay. And then move forward a few years, we find out that they've discovered like a hardware wallet under a blanket, under a trapdoor, under a bed.
You're thinking about the Silk Road guy.
Oh, was that a different one?
That was a different case.
All right. So then there was this weird couple. Like, she was a kind of shitty rapper.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a couple of white kids, right? They mm-hmm. looked about 25 years old.
Literally living on Wall Street.
Yeah. And everyone's like, they don't look like hackers. Okay. Fine. And they've got an ongoing case.
Right, so they were arrested, I want to say almost a couple of years ago, charged, pled guilty a year ago. Now, I think that they only really pled guilty to money laundering. I'm not sure if they pled guilty to the actual hacking.
What was their punishment?
Well, that's the thing. There hasn't been any. We're still waiting. It's been a year at this point. And, you know, to top everything else off, she's been showing up at various Bitcoin events.
Well, that isn't the largest part of my conspiracy, because everyone turns up. Even Dorian Nakamoto turned up at one. Like, everyone seems to just turn up at events. But what's the value of those 127,000, 137,000?
Billions.
Yeah, I don't know, but billions.
Okay.
4.5 billion-ish. Actually, it's more than that now. I don't know.
And so one conspiracy hat of mine would say the government won't give her back, and they'll say this is a trade-off for you to operate Tether.
Maybe.
You can keep operating Tether, and we're keeping this. That's your fee. But it makes me almost think it's like, these people weren't the hackers. They found a couple of people and said, hey, take the hit. You won't go to jail.
It's one possibility. I mean, though I've seen at least in some of the news articles, it seemed to be implying that Ilya basically admitted to hacking or doing the actual theft.
Okay.
And then I think that Heather, the girlfriend or wife, she only admitted to the like money laundering and to defrauding the federal government somehow.
So had they been spending the coins?
I think they spent a little bit, but the vast majority of it they were still holding on to, because it's, if I recall, because it's been over a year since I read it, is like they had this really convoluted accounting system where they were just even trying to keep track of all the coins and trying to, you know, not leak too much information. But I don't think that they were very good at understanding, you know, how to navigate to the very difficult aspects of Bitcoin privacy.
Yeah. How did they get caught?
I mean, I think that basically some of the coins got traced to a KYC account. There was also some relation to one of the Bitcoin mixers, maybe Bitcoin Fog. And I think that Ilya made some sort of deal with the government and like helped them, you know, crack into that Bitcoin mixing service and take it down as well. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of fishy stuff going on, a lot of stuff we don't know. And it seems like their plea deal and likely punishment is going to be absurdly light given the levity of the crime.
With the connection to Bitcoin Fog, do you think there's maybe some reason that Roman ended up being arrested? Or is that a stretch?
I mean, I don't think we have any reason to believe it's directly related, but you know, it's just more evidence of the government wanting to take down any strong privacy services that are making law enforcement's job more difficult.
God, if you're selling 137,000 Bitcoin that you've stolen, you've got a lot of money that's very hard to spend.
Yeah.
I mean, if you... You say they had a complicated accounting method. Had they kept them in different places or something?
Yeah, I think there was some report of them just having like some giant spreadsheets with just, you know, hundreds of addresses, you know, trying to keep things segregated. But basically, it seemed like it was a very manual thing. And, you know, if you're managing that level of complexity manually, you're going to make mistakes.
Yeah. They needed a Jameson on their team. What are your suspicions?
Well, I think it's even more suspicious that Heather has been showing up at various events and from what I've been told, ingratiating herself with a lot of people, trying to get close to people. Who knows if she's like trying to get information. I think, you know,
turn spook.
It's likely that she's working with the state. Who knows, you know, what they're trying to get her to do.
What does she look like?
I posted the photo.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I want to see if I met her.
So I posted the photo an hour or so ago, and I've had a stream of more people coming to me and saying, oh, crap, like, I had dinner with this person, or I shared a ride with this person, and, you know, a lot of people have been having conversations, not even knowing the background, and you know, who knows what information they might leak to her.
She looks familiar, but I don't know. Maybe just be a familiar face. See if you can find any more photos of her.
Okay.
Was that her at the conference?
No, I didn't get any photos of her this week.
Okay, so she's a potential spook. So it's a weird thing. We've got a Trump potential incoming administration talking a big game about leaving Bitcoiners the fuck alone, holding Bitcoin, potential strategic treasury asset, wanting to break down parts of the deep state and the administrative state. And then you've got her, who's potentially working for the state, either through a Biden administration directly or the administrative and deep state, which might become part of the Republican administration if Trump wins.
Well, I mean, we already know that we're all on lists, right? It's just we haven't known what those lists are being used for.
I'm on this. I was told it's called secondary. So after I interviewed Bekele, when I flew back into, we had this. Do you think it's bad to talk about that meeting?
Have I ever? You've done it loads before.
I'm here. The actual meeting it with Michael Peterson.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he said it on the podcast, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, we think we had a CIA visit. Mm. So when I met somebody from USAID when I was over there, and they asked to have a meeting with us, and it was they invited me to the embassy, but I said no, come to my hotel. And like three people turned up. I asked Michael Peterson to join me, and he was a USAID person, a State Department person, and then this other guy just said he worked for the government. And I was just naive. We just sat there asking. They were just asking about Bitcoin. But sure. The guy who said he worked for the government was asking questions like, how would a Guatemalan gang use Bitcoin to extort the El Salvadoran government? And while the other guys were like, what's mining and what's, et cetera.
I've had similar experiences.
Yeah.
You know, just like, help us understand like how people could be doing malicious things. Like, what should we be looking for type of stuff?
Well, it was only after he left that Michael said to me, I think that guy was CIA. And I was like, really? Didn't think I'd be in that world. But ever since then, so when I flew back over and I went through passport control, they checked my passport and then they said, oh, you have to come with me. And it was like, they put me in it was like Houston or Dallas. I can't remember where. Maybe Austin. But anyway, wherever you're flying from San Salvador. And it was just like another part, immigration room. And it was many South Americans in there and me. And you wait your turn, and they ask you the same questions they ask you at the front desk, and then they let you go. It only took like a couple of minutes, but it's almost every time I go into the US, this happens now. Mm-hmm. Like I always joke with you, the only time it hasn't happened recently is when I went in with the kids, which was interesting.
Yeah, I'm actually surprised that I've never had any issues at the border.
But I remember Eric Voorhees, he's talked about that.
What's that? I don't know.
Having issues. I think they took his passport. No, his laptop. Mm. But yeah, so But when people say you're on the list, you go, am I really though?
Mm-hmm.
Am I really?
Mm-hmm.
I just make a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Damn. Well, anyway, so we've got to keep an eye out for her. It's such a weird situation. It's like it's almost like the U.S. government's at war with itself or what it should be.
Well, you know, I think Peter Valkenburg? He had a really good quote a few months ago where he basically said, look, you know, the U.S. government is not a monolith. It's a kraken, right? Like one hand doesn't necessarily talk to the other. You know, it's such a huge organization that, you know, every agency is trying to do its own thing and trying to figure out, you know, how do I even treat this system? So we should not expect for there to be a coherent response from the government broadly on how they're treating us.
Hmm. So what do you make of yesterday? By the way, my opinions evolved.
Okay. Yeah. What on Trump?
Yeah. What he did yesterday. I was a bit like, meh. Afterwards, but I thought about it a bit more and I'm like, oh, no, it was very positive. But
yeah, I mean, look, it was some good pandering. I for one, felt seen by Trump, that he recognized that I'm a highly intelligent individual. But look, he had a lot of good talking points. He's been fed the talking points from Bitcoiners, right? Yeah. It didn't come out of nowhere. But if you're, for example, like comparing Trump's speech to RFK's speech, RFK has been doing his homework a lot longer than Trump. And so he's been able to come up with, you know, I think, much more coherent policy and opinions. And so I think that most Bitcoiners would probably agree that RFK would be like better for Bitcoin. And it's just a shame that he's in the position that he is in. And meanwhile, we have Trump trying to play catch up.
Yeah, and I'm a little bit forgiven in that you have to, like, I think we have to understand the amount of things these people are dealing with, and Trump, on top of trying to be elected, is dealing with multiple lawsuits, accusations, assassination attempts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you stand run-of-the-mill stuff as a popular ex-president, soon to be maybe 47th president, but that you rely on a group of advisors around you, and you have some basic key talking points, but you're not an expert. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I'm okay with if in the background his belief and thoughts are, well, this is good and we should protect it. If he doesn't fully understand it, okay.
No, it's a learning experience for him too, yeah. Right? It's like he obviously didn't have much of a clue which of his talking points were going to be bigger than others. And he was genuinely surprised when he said, you know, I'm going to fire Gary Gensler, and everyone went wild. Yeah. And so, you know, he's not dumb. He's going to learn from that, and he's going to lean into the talking points where, you know, he's getting feedback from the public when he's doing these speeches. This is one of the reasons he goes around and does all these rallies. He's honing his craft. He's honing his message. Yeah, he's testing. So look, it's really no different than how comedians, stand-up comedians exactly, work, yeah. right? It's just politics instead of comedy, though he has a bit of comedy too.
He's quite funny. But yeah, so I was kind of okay with it. And I also, like, one of the things that was on my mind, I was thinking about last night was, you know, he has survived an assassination attempt, of which we don't know if that is just some lone weirdo or some... more deep-rooted, complicated attempt to get rid of somebody who's a threat to other people, whatever. But that I'm sure plays on your mind. If you know, you wake up one day, you think, "Holy shit! If I had not have just turned my head at that moment, I'd be dead." Mm-hmm. Add to that, I'm not going to pass judgment on the accusations or the lawsuits, but it does appear that some of them appear to be more egregious attempts to try and take him down. While some are things that, you know, should be questioned.
Yeah.
I think, was it Georgia State that he phoned up and said, find me some votes kind of thing? Whatever they are. Anyone listening, don't get angry. Mm-hmm. The point being is that he feels attacked, mm-hmm. and he feels like the administrative state, the deep state, whatever you want, is attacking him. Oh, well, there's a bunch of people here who kind of like me are feeling attacked. And all they are free citizens who want to be free and left the fuck alone. So I can see a scenario where he's come around to Bitcoin and kind of gets it and feels an affinity with Bitcoin. As if it's knowing who I know who's talked to him or his team and explained it, that kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think that anyone rises to the level of politics that he has without doing some questionable things, right? So I don't necessarily pick on any one politician more than another. I think they've all got skeletons in the closet.
Yeah. Who's the best slime bag for me? But I think we felt a little bit disappointed afterwards, weren't we?
I was very happy that the conversation happened there, and mm-hmm. that was really cool. But the actual speech, I thought, was meh.
Yeah, but I thought afterwards, it's the fact that the speech happened was not meh afterwards. I was like, actually, the fact that he was there, even if it took some lobbying, he was there, and he was talking pro about Bitcoin, and it is on the agenda, is on the radar.
Definitely.
I think, yeah. Is there a more high-profile person in the world right now?
No.
You could maybe go, okay, well, him and Elon are the two most high-profile, but you know, they've essentially got the most high-profile person in the world to come to Nashville and give a speech about Bitcoin and talk relatively positively about it. That's as opposed to an administration for the last 4 years who's done everything to attack it.
Yeah, it's huge. It's raising the profile. I think... Well, first of all, I was surprised when El Salvador was the first nation to go the route of declaring Bitcoin legal tender. I had predicted it was going to happen like 5 years earlier, but I was predicting it to be a micronation, you know, really, really small government that has a much bigger incentive to do that. So, I was surprised that a country the size of El Salvador was the first mover. And now it's doubly surprising that the United States would be the next one after that. You know, I was expecting Bukele to be going around to all of his peers, you know, Latin America area and saying, hey, you guys need to get in on this. And I'm sure he is doing that and it will happen. But it is kind of crazy that we may see America actually take a sort of leadership position on Bitcoin, the entire space. And maybe it is... partially because, you know, Trump has felt attacked and marginalized, and you see some parallels with the government attacking us.
Do we know how much Bitcoin El Salvador holds at the moment? And how
completely public on they have a whole website dedicated.
Oh, do they?
It. Yeah. They have a custom mempool space instance.
Do they?
Yeah, they do.
I didn't even know this. I feel like they could have pushed it harder.
I want to say it's around 5,000.
Oh, here we go. It's a good stack.
It's a bit hard to see from here, but yeah, nearly 6,000 Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So another 8 in the last day. Did they say they were going to buy one a day for like...
Yeah. See, it says plus 8 in the past 7 days. So it's basically one per day.
So they are actually doing that. Mm-hmm. Do we know what their average buy price is versus what it's worth now? So can you figure that out from here?
I don't think so.
I mean, they're almost certainly up.
I would guess probably around 30,000.
Yeah. So what's it saying they've got there?
394 million.
Based on current value. I'm sure somebody can do the work very easily to go back and figure that out. Look at the stepladder up, staircase up. I mean, at some point, their stack's going to be a billion. They're going to have a billion of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
And they will have spent, who knows what on that, a couple hundred million. And that's going to be that story where other countries are going to go, oh, but we're too late. It's like when your friends see that you've bought Bitcoin, maybe bought a new house or something, they think, oh, you've done so well, you're so lucky. And they think they're too late. That's the only slight issue on that.
I mean, it's also entirely possible that some other nation states are stealthily buying Bitcoin and
mining Bitcoin. You know,
acquiring it, however, mm-hmm. and just don't want to announce it because you announce it and you make the race go even faster.
Is he having a chat with Elon Musk there?
Yeah. But it's nothing relevant.
Still funny and weird. I mean, look, if the US is the second country, that would be fascinating. But
if I was Bouquet, they'd definitely make a meme about Bitcoin with it as America second.
Yeah. But again, it's kind of interesting in that we are in this world where we have it now on the geopolitical table. And I think that was another observation of Trump's, which I think that's something that would ring true with him when he thinks, well, if we don't do it, somebody else will. Well, we're America.
Well, yeah, look, it's the industry. And remember, he mentioned industry numerous times in his speech.
Compared to the steel industry.
It's the industry that has put together all these political action groups that have been outspending all the other industries in America, and that got a lot of attention.
Hmm.
It's the industry that has a lot of people who have started going out and, you know, creating those political connections, creating all of those back roads. I'm not really deep into politics myself. I'm not a fan of a lot of the sort of double-faced nature of it. But, the people who are and who believe that there's an actual need for us to use whatever political advantages we can get, they have definitely made a lot of progress over the past year.
The coolest part I thought was the fact that he doubled, tripled down on the free Ross thing. And it's still so wild to me that this weird, nerdy internet money might free a human being from prison.
Well, of all of his promises, I think that would be the easiest to actually accomplish. Yeah. So it seems to be a very low risk maneuver.
Yeah, all eyes on November. It's going to be very interesting. Look, we actually got you here to talk about security ESR.
I guess we could do that.
Regular bull market, catch up with LOP, talk about security, where we're at, what people should be doing, because people email the show a lot, and it's about this time that they're starting to email us and say, what should I do? Pete, I have this much Bitcoin. What should I do?
Well, you've already failed.
Yeah, don't tell me how much Bitcoin you've got. And I've got my own personal questions about certain things, certain security practices that I'm thinking about, and I'm going to get to that. I just think as a background, for people who haven't heard the story, and I know we've done it a couple of times, but the swatting story is super interesting. Can we just run through that again, so people can understand what you went through that led you to really think even in more detail about security?
Yeah, so summing up about 15 years of history in a few minutes, I started out as just a regular Bitcoin nerd. I was interested in the space for a couple of years, had some open source projects, went full time, started tweeting regularly, basically daily basis about Bitcoin, went from having a few hundred followers when I started in 2015 to by the end of 2017, I think I had over 100,000 at that point. And what a lot of people don't realize is that, as you grow the number of people who are listening to you, you're getting more attention. And it's not all going to be good attention, right? It's sort of a law of large numbers that despite the fact that the vast majority of humanity are good people, moral people who don't want to hurt others, there's always going to be that small, like single digit percentage of psychopaths and sociopaths and people who will do whatever they can if they think it benefits them. So it was in 2017 when my entire neighborhood got shut down by police and SWAT teams because someone had decided that they wanted to try to extort me. And they did that by calling up my local law enforcement, pretending to be me, and using all of the right trigger words to get a lethal response pointed at my doorstep. And he basically said that they were me, that they had murdered someone, they were holding hostages, they had explosives, and they were demanding a ransom. So that's all you need to get, you know, lethal force deployed against you in America. And, you know, I had a few fortunate things go on that day, mainly that I actually was not at home at the specific time when it happened. I was at the gym and I ran into the law enforcement blockade trying to get back to my home. And it took a little while to figure out that they were looking for me. So, you know, if not for that, things could have ended very differently because I literally had several weapons laying out in my living room at that time because I had been to the shooting range the day before and I was going to be cleaning them, you know, the next day. So that and the fact that I had dogs, you know, law enforcement and dogs don't get along very well.
And we've seen footage of law enforcement responding to situations and trigger happy shooting people when yes, they're completely
there,
in the wrong.
There have been innocent swatting victims who have been accidentally killed by law enforcement in some cases because they had firearms and they thought that they were being attacked by criminals. So, you know, short version, that ended quickly and without anyone being harmed. But of course, I was fearful for my life because I realized that now anyone who wanted to could easily find me and come and, you know, try to extort me, harm me, so on and so forth. And that kicked off a very long process.
What's the theory of the using swatting to extort you? How do they extort you in that process?
Yeah, so it's basically that, you know, this is a potentially lethal incident. And when someone swats you, they can do it again. In fact, we know of celebrities who have been swatted dozens of times. And like law enforcement, obviously this varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but there seems to be this issue of like law enforcement is just stupid and can't seem to like write down a note that, hey, this person is a high profile target that it keeps getting swatted. I think there are one or two cities where they have implemented some like specific white lists for this type of problem, but I guess it's just not widespread enough for large law enforcement organizations to like have dedicated policies around it. So, you know, you keep doing it over and over and over again. You only have to win one time, you know, for something to go wrong, people to get hurt. So it's a different type of threat. And the main reason it's a crazy type of threat is because it's totally asymmetric to the attacker. The attacker is not risking bodily harm to themselves at all. They're actually getting two completely different sets of people to be interacting physically and possibly having, you know, lethal consequences.
Have you seen this has started happening a lot with like live streamers as well?
I have seen it.
Well, that's how it started. You know, it started in the video gaming community.
Oh, interesting.
Where basically, you know, popular live streamer video gamers who would get large audiences and then inevitably piss a few people off, it became a game to have the SWAT team bust down their door while they were live streaming just so you could laugh at them and, you know, them being afraid, basically.
Have they caught many people who've actually instigated the swatting?
No, I think the case closure rate on this is probably in the like 10 to 20% range.
Is it harsh punishment if you're caught doing that?
Well, I can tell you what happened to my attacker. Now, I believe that one of the cases where someone actually got killed, there was a decent amount of prison time because it was kind of like second degree murder. Mm. But first of all, after the fact, like once it's over, it's very difficult to get law enforcement to pursue these cases, because it's just because of how law enforcement prioritizes dealing with criminals. And because once the incident is over, there's no longer clear and present danger to anyone from their perspective, I would argue differently, they generally do not have it very high on their priority list. This is why, like for my own case, I had to expend a lot of my own personal time and money doing a lot of the legwork or law enforcement, because they wouldn't. It took me over a year to get the attention of federal authorities to do anything about it. And it was kind of happenstance. I was fortunate enough that I was at a Satoshi Roundtable event and I met someone who had the right FBI connections to the cybercrime division who specifically dealt with this type of thing. Mm. And so I gathered a lot of the information by posting a $100,000 bounty on my attacker. That was by far the most helpful thing that I did. And so basically their friends started rolling over on them and giving me a lot of information. And even once I had collected it all and handed it over to them, it took several years for anything to happen. I had given up on getting a closure to the case. And then once they finally found the guy, you know, it turned out he was this punk teenager living in his mom's basement Once I learned about his whole life story, I generally felt sorry for the guy. You know, he kind of fell in with the wrong crowd. He ended up using his skills for bad things instead of good things. And, I went to court and I met him. I said, hey, I get it. You know, I did some stupid shit when I was a kid and I hope you'll turn your life around. And so he didn't get any incarceration. I didn't want him to. I don't think that would have helped his life. He had like community service and he was told like he needed to complete his GED and, you know, get his driver's license and become a productive member of society. But, you know, he's one of many. There is a lot of people out there doing that. And we've seen like a lot of teenagers these days are doing SIM swapping. They're doing social engineering of people trying to crack into your exchange accounts and drain them. And
Gen Z.
It's an interesting phenomenon that I've learned a lot about, because here's what happened when they actually caught the guy. I was told through my attorneys, hey, the FBI found him, but the federal district attorney in that jurisdiction is declining to prosecute. Why? Because apparently the federal system doesn't have a like juvenile system. It's very difficult for them to charge people who do stuff when they're not an adult. And so the only reason that I actually ended getting any sort of justice was because the state district attorney did agree to prosecute. And so this is why a lot of these teenagers are doing this stuff. Some of them are doing it because there are adults who are kind of training them and saying, hey, you can do this, you can get rich, and you can get away with it. Even if you get caught, it'll be a slap on the wrist because the juvenile system doesn't want to throw you in prison for a long period of time.
That's what that kid said on the phone to Jim Seth.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Huh. I wonder how that kid's doing now. Yeah. Can I talk about when I came to that house?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, bear in mind, I'd never seen a gun, like really. And this is before the recording of episode three of What Bitcoin Did with Jameson. And I said I wanted to shoot a gun. So he invited me over to his house and I felt like I walked into the Alamo. There was just guns everywhere. Big ones, little ones.
Yeah, I was like, which ones do you want to shoot? We can only put so many in the truck.
Yeah, I was like, I'm a little bit nervous. Have you shot a gun yet?
Yeah, a few times. But I've never actually shot I've shot like handguns and a shotgun. I've never shot a rifle.
I can't remember what we shot. We shot a bunch of guns and it just, it was interesting.
I think I did get you on the Chris Vector, you know, the sub gun.
Yeah.
That has a V-shaped slide to it.
One of them was an older gun. I remember that. There was an older gun. I just remember the first one we shot just being blown away by the absolute fucking power of it. Mm-hmm. Absolute power of it. It was just like, wow. Okay, so back to security. Even people who've heard our previous shows, they're probably in a different security bracket now. You kind of go up security brackets every 4 years. You're going to have people who maybe have a few $100 of Bitcoin or maybe a few thousand, or they've got to the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, even tens of millions. It feels like every bracket, you have to reconsider your security. Mm-hmm. And it's something I've had to go through. You've probably had to go through. Kurt's probably had to go through. You certainly have had to go through. There's a lot to think about with this, but it's personal mistakes. It can be accidents that happen. It can be hacks. It can be violent attacks. Yeah, there's a lot of things to think about. I'm certainly in the region of thinking more about violence and less so my mistakes. I think I'm long enough not to make the mistakes, but not being completely naive. But somebody just first starting to think about Bitcoin and their security, where do you start with people?
Well, the first thing is the mindset, right? And so I think a really good rule of thumb is that you should take whatever the value of your stash is and you should 10x it. Because, as we know, Bitcoin can be volatile and it can do a 10x in a fairly short period of time. And basically, you don't want to be caught unawares. You don't want to have $10,000 worth of Bitcoin that's now worth over $100,000, but you only have $10,000 level of security around it.
Which actually did happen to me before I went to Casa Multisig. I happily admit now I had 6 figures of Bitcoin on a single hardware wallet. Yeah. I'd backed up the private key, but that's what I had. Mm-hmm. And I was like, shit, I need to do something about it. And I think I spoke to Jeremy and said, help. So that does happen.
Yeah. So I generally try to break things down into like 3 or 4 levels, right? So there's pocket money, maybe $100 to $1,000, like the amount of cash that you would carry around in your wallet. That's your spending money. It's not going to have a substantial life impact on you if it's lost, stolen, or whatever. And, you know, it's fine to just have that in a hot wallet, like on your phone. No big deal. Next level is when you start getting into non-trivial amounts, like savings account level, investment account level, thousands of dollars. That's when you should, at the very least, invest $100 in a hardware device, whether it's Trezor, Ledger, Cold Card. They're all great. There is no perfect hardware device. I don't really recommend one over another because they all have trade-offs. And the reason you should do that is that protects you from like 98% of the theft possibilities by just getting your keys off the internet. You're no longer having 8 billion people that can potentially knock on the door and through the internet and try to access your keys in whatever way possible,
and the counterparty risk.
Yeah, absolutely. Counterparty risk is something that very few people think about even today. We can definitely get into that in a bit. And then moving forward from that is like when you're at the point where you have a substantial percentage of your net worth that would meaningfully negatively impact your future and potentially your heirs' future, if you're looking at like multi-generational wealth, that's when you need to go to the level that you're eliminating single points of failure.
I think you can add in your mental health into that as well.
Absolutely. I know. One of the most common pieces of feedback we get and sort of compliments and praise for Casa is that I sleep better at night now because people are no longer in their own shoddily architected solution that they're the only ones that have thought through the ramifications. Another way of thinking about this that I really like to talk about, anyone who's been in the space long enough has likely heard the vires in numeris line. So strength in numbers, safety in numbers. And I think that a lot of people don't apply that broadly enough. People usually think that just means, Bitcoin is safe because of cryptography. And that's true. Like there's large numbers and entropy and randomness that secure a variety of aspects of the protocol. But even stepping back from just the technical level and like thinking about security of me and you and everyone else in the space and how we're architecting our storage, it's similar to the way that we agree that open source software is a highly safe and secure thing. It's not because the code is automatically better quality. It's because when you have more eyes on something, you have diversity of perspectives and skills, and it's more likely that flaws in the system will be discovered and someone will just raise their hand and say, hey, you should do something about this. And so point being, it should be the same thing about how you architect your self-custody. If you're the only one who has thought about and architected your self-custody, you're probably missing something. And this is not because you're dumb. I mean, this is true of even experts like myself. You know, I'm not perfect. I can miss things. It's when you have a group, a team of people who are all looking at a problem and looking for flaws, it's just more likely that you're going to find them and fix them ahead of time and you'll be able to prevent catastrophe. So this is why even at Casa, we've had people, experts, you know, at my level, highly technical, nerdy folks who come to us and say, look, I had my own setup and it was pretty good, but I was never actually sure that I was seeing all of the angles. And, you know, now that I'm in a system that, you know, has had dozens of people looking at it and countless people actually using it for, I guess, 6 years now, you know, this is an ongoing iterative process and it only gets better over time.
Can I talk you through a personal conundrum I have?
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty well known I'm a Casa customer. 99.9% of my Bitcoin is in that. The rest is in a single sig wallet. It's pocket money, like you say.
Mm-hmm.
But I started to think about my security because of violence quite a bit. You run that GitHub.
Mm-hmm.
What's your GitHub?
Yeah, it's the Bitcoin physical attacks log.
And some of them are fucking brutal.
Oh, yeah.
Like drills to people's knees. And so I start to worry about that because I'm a known person mm-hmm. in Bitcoin and doing a podcast and traveling. I don't tweet my travel as much anymore these days. You've warned me about that, which was a good warning. But but I'm conscious of that. And I've set my security up in a way whereby if somebody comes to my house and wants to get something from me, they're going to get far more money by taking the couch and the TV
yeah.
than they are from the Bitcoin. Because it doesn't exist there. I can't provide it.
Mm-hmm.
They can get one key because I have my mobile phone with me. But as we know, cars is 3 or 5. They're not going to get two keys in that scenario. But having really good security doesn't do anything about the fact that somebody doesn't believe you.
Yep.
And so I've been talking to Danny quite a bit about this, about I've been thinking about open sourcing and making public what my security is. Like being really shout from the top, this is exactly how my Bitcoin is set up. Let me run you through it. In that, for you to be able to access my Bitcoin, you have to be aware that I cannot alone release my Bitcoin.
Yep.
It takes 3 people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 2 of those people live a long way from me. And one of them I'm trying to be as detailed as I can without giving too much away. It's based in an office environment.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So there's additional physical access restrictions.
Yeah, so you have to get to both those. You have to essentially kidnap me or someone, get to both those locations, get to specific people, one through an office full of people, and then there's a massive time delay on one of the key signings, right? Yep. That's as much information I'd give as possible. There's a lot more to it.
Yeah.
But I was thinking of open sourcing it all and saying, almost on my website, this is what the process you have to go through. Having it, tweeting it out, having it on a laminated piece of paper at my fucking house with a sign on my house that says, there's no Bitcoin stored here.
That's good.
Like the shops, there's no cash.
Exactly.
And so if somebody comes in and said, this is it, you cannot break through. Do you understand the game theory of why I'm thinking of doing this?
An article called How to Rob Peter McCormick.
How to Rob My Bitcoin.
Yeah, no. Okay, so common saying, your security through obscurity isn't security. If you have an insecure solution and keeping the details of it private doesn't actually make you any more secure. You should be able to talk about the architecture of your security without negatively actually impacting your actual threat model. Now, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say like named individual X at this address has the key, right?
That's, because you can send the people to all three locations.
Because then you're giving people an actual target, which is not great. That would, you know, decrease your robustness a bit. Because we have actually seen organized crime now that will spend weeks surveilling their targets to try to figure out, you know, what are your patterns, who are you related to, and who are you dealing with, you know, who else might be a part of your security setup. So definitely just talking about it at the high level, I think would be good. Of course, feel free to let me review it first. Yeah,
he thinks it's a good idea, actually, how to rob Pete McCormick. It's kind of like a triggering title, but
yeah,
makes
sense. I think it's a good idea, as long as we pass it pile up first.
Now, we live in a country without
without guns. Great self-defense laws, right?
No, we have guns, but the guns are only owned by the criminals, the police, who you could maybe say are the criminals as well.
You probably can't even store your guns in an easily accessible location when they're loaded so that you could actually use them, right?
So the very few people who do have them, who have a license, maybe you're a sporting shooter or a farmer, you have to have very tight security in terms of where it's locked away. They do a lot of checks.
Yeah.
I'm basically never having a gun. I don't really want one in my house, to be honest. I don't. Yeah, I know Americans don't like this, but I'm kind of happy with being in an unarmed and unpolite society.
Yeah. But look, there's more to physical security than just weapons. That's only that's like the last defense. Like, oh shit, the rest of your layers of security have all failed.
But if someone comes to my house with a gun and I don't have a gun. Mm-hmm. That is a scenario I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
It could be a possibility.
Yeah. Now, something else that comes up a lot that I thought that you might have started leaning into was the whole issue of duress wallets and paying people off.
Yeah. So I've thought about that as well. The problem with the duress wallet and to pay them off, but like a decoy wallet is like, so even if you had like a whole Bitcoin on there,
right?
They're like, yeah, we know you've got more than that.
Yeah.
So I don't think it is a decoy wallet. I don't think you can have decoy wallets. I think you can have ransoms, preloaded ransoms. Mm-hmm. And almost if someone comes to you and said, look, this is the scenario you have to go through for this, very unlikely. And if you torture me, if you get arrested, you're going to face quite a bit of time in jail. Take this and fuck off.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess.
But I don't want to even do that.
Yeah. I don't advocate either way, because really I think that it's an intractable problem. And the reason for that is that you're speculating on the knowledge and psychology of a potential future attacker that you know nothing about. Mm. You don't know their motivations. You don't know what they know about you. You don't know what they're looking for. Basically, you don't know whether giving them a token offering will appease them or piss them off even more.
Or send them back in a month later and say, have you reloaded it for me?
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely something I think a lot about. I think I might write it up and send it to you and say, what do you think about this?
Yeah.
But I also feel like I'm at that point. One thing that concerns me, I think people think you have more Bitcoin than you have.
Of course.
I know for a fact there's people who think I've got more than I have because they said how wealthy they think I am. And I'm like, you're a long way off the mark. I've been in a 5-year lawsuit. Fuck off. but that's just like, it doesn't matter what you've got. It's always what they think you've got. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem. But there is scenarios where Bitcoin, you know, Donald Trump does come to power and says the United States is going to buy 1 million Bitcoin. And then Bitcoin shoots up to $1-2 million a coin. And even if you've got five, you are.
Yeah, every whole coiner is going to be a target.
Every whole, yeah. And so then what do you do about this? When do you think about personal security? I mean, we see it at the Bitcoin events. People have personal security these days. When is that a relevant thing to have?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that, this is why I maintain that list of physical attacks, is because I'm just trying to see what the trend is, what the risk level is, what the criminal element of society is viewing Bitcoin as, you know, the ROI of wrench attacking us. Every time that a wrench attack succeeds, it's bad for all of us because it's teaching the criminals that this is worth their time, that it's easier to bust a Bitcoiner's kneecap than to break into a bank or an armored truck or whatever. And it's you know, security is always an ongoing thing. But, you know, when I was at the conference yesterday, I was just sitting in the middle of the crowd, actually next to Caitlin Long. And, you know, we would have a few people come by from time to time. They're like, hey, you know, nice to see you, and so on. And then I noticed this wave of people just moving in one direction. I'm like, what's going on? You know, is someone about to get hurt? And I look over and it's Michael Saylor. And it's a crushing mass of people just moving in on him. I'm like, you know what? I do not envy him. Like, I don't want to be that level of recognizable.
Yeah. If I've got 10 billion...
fair trade-off.
Yeah, fair trade-off. So, yeah. So what is this? Before we look at this, what is the trend that you're starting to see?
Well, there's some links at the top to a presentation by, I think, Nigel Walsh. And I might have his name wrong.
Oh, there's slides here.
But he did a good breakdown and like had some charts. And the short version is that there seems to be a pretty strong correlation between the price of Bitcoin and the rate of physical attacks.
Okay.
And this is sensible because, of course, whenever we have a bull market and everybody is getting FOMO and your taxi driver is talking about Bitcoin, that's when the criminals are starting to think about it more. And they're also looking to, you know, find targets that they can score against.
And is there a pattern to how, is it just violence and extortion?
There are certainly things that are more common. So the worst things that you can do are to engage in face-to-face trades. That's where a lot of this happens, is someone's just like, hey, I want to buy a bunch of Bitcoin from you. And then they kind of take you to a hotel room and tie you up. And that's the end of that. Probably the next most problematic one is generally... people with large social media followings, influencers who are flashing their wealth, they're getting hit a lot. Other than that, it seems to be kind of random. You know, just people who have amassed a lot of Bitcoin and they may not have as big of a social media presence, but like another thing is, I think it's in, is it Sweden or Norway, where they have basically no privacy and you can find where anybody lives because it's public record.
Oh, you can do that in the UK.
Yeah, the UK is not good for that.
So all those countries are having more incidents as well.
Interestingly, when you look through this, I don't feel like I've seen an incident of anyone in our circle, our known circle of Bitcoin, who've been done.
Well, also... the vast majority of the attacks that are happening are not reported.
Huh.
The vast majority.
And so do you know of this?
Yes.
And would you say this is because of embarrassment?
Fear.
Fear.
You know, we've had clients at Casa attacked physically. And they, first of all, a lot of people don't even want to go to law enforcement because that can create public records. And then if they're public about it, you know, that can still make you a target. You know, other people might see and say, oh, I'm going to go attack them. And so I think one of the recent news stories that broke of the organized crime gang that was going all over America hitting different people, they actually hit this one woman twice. It was like, first they simjacked her and drained her Coinbase account. And then as a part of that, they went through her email. I think they realized she also had a Gemini account or something. And then they physically went to her house and put a gun to her head. And that was an interesting case because she was so distraught after already having been you know, wiped out on one account that she was like, kill me. You can't have it. Like, I'm not giving it up. And they actually left without taking anything.
Damn. That was ballsy.
Yeah.
So knowing what you know about the industry, would you say I'm a solid potential target?
I would say the vast majority of public figures in Bitcoin are underprepared. I've actually gone through and I put my black hat on and I've tried to find a number of people who are well known in this space of like, you know, if I was an attacker, would I be able to hit them? A lot of people are very easy to find. And I'm actually surprised that we haven't heard of more people getting hit. And so, and I do think it's only a matter of time.
Because my I'm in the UK. Very easy to find where you live in the UK. Mm. Public records, because I own companies. So that I can't do anything about. It's very, very difficult. Plus, people know the town I live in, and I'm not moving. So I have to accept that's a reality now. I do have good home security in terms of cameras and alarms. And I do have good Bitcoin security, and I can't get to it.
Yeah,
my
physical security is a completely separate game, and that's what I think a lot of people aren't really talking about.
Yeah, what I don't think I am prepared for is the physical security side and the potential violence for people who think they can get something they can't. That's my only scenario I think about. I don't really think about the rest, and I don't know what the solution is living in the UK. When you are a public profile and you can't have weapons and people can find when you are, is it just, do I just need to hire security?
I mean, I think hiring security people is basically one of the last things that you do after you've done all of the other low hanging fruit. So, you know, I have a whole article that I've published about physical security, a separate one about guns. So you can skip the one about firearms and home defense. But look, there's multiple things that you can do around your home to make you less attractive as a target. So, you know, fences, dogs, hardened doors, windows, alarm systems. I can send you the link to the article. We've got it all listed out there. But you know, security is a multi-layered system. So, you know, there is no one single thing that you can do. But also, you know, if you want to get, you know, really dark, your family that's another issue. Is like, what are you going to do? You're not going to hire physical security for each one of your kids to follow them around 24/7 and make sure that nobody kidnaps them and takes them hostage. Because that's a situation where your Bitcoin security becomes almost irrelevant.
Of course.
Because you still have full control of everything. It's your child. It's your loved one that you don't have control over.
Then the attacker has
It's leverage.
They have leverage, but they also have... They've gone up the risk profile in terms of the punishment should they be caught. Because there's one going in a house and hitting you with a wrench, the second kidnapping a child and issuing a ransom note. So they've got a risk. They've also got a time risk because they have to hold that hostage for a certain period of time.
Yeah. So, and there have been a couple of incidents
It feels more like a South American thing.
Yeah.
You hear a lot of kidnappings for ransoms with like professional footballers.
Yeah. There was actually an incident, I think, in Hong Kong a few months ago where some people actually kidnapped like a toddler. But it ended well. They actually got caught within like a day. So
Hong Kong police arrest two women over allegedly abducting 3-year-old boy for $5 million crypto ransom. I mean, could just sell or get rid of all my Bitcoin. go poor. What, there was an England one down there at the bottom. I saw that machete one. Ramesh Nair. I got this weird email recently. Should I talk about that one, Danny?
I don't think there's anything wrong with talking about that one, yeah.
I got an email from somebody who told me they'd been kidnapped to... I can't remember exactly. Have you got the email?
I wouldn't be able to find the email quickly. General idea was he'd been kidnapped and like driven to some weird location.
And threatened for his...
But the way it read, and I could be totally wrong, this might be being paranoid, is it actually read like he was trying to fish for information off Peter and he was making up a story.
Yeah. It was really weird. I was like, because they were kind of like asking for my advice. And I was like, well, one, go to the police and... Like all I can say is like for my own personal security, I don't have any access to my Bitcoin. It's all controlled by other entities and people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, that was being the honest thing in case this was somebody thinking, here's the honest thing. Rather than going, yeah, I've got it all in a single wallet and the keys printed on a piece of paper in my pocket. Like, you know,
So this just happened. Three guys physically robbed me at my home. They were armed with machetes. They knew I had crypto and knew where I lived. They forced me to open my ledger and then transferred all my crypto out. Luckily, I didn't get stabbed. I'm still in a state of shock.
That's tricky.
Yeah. I think about it a lot at the moment. I do think about it a lot. Casa offers a premium service now where you can run through consult on the security, right?
Yeah, our private client offering is expanding to be, you know, security in general beyond just your keys, you know, thinking about the privacy ramifications, operational security, physical security, because it has, as we've learned, it's becoming about more than just the keys themselves. It's really about many different aspects of your life.
How much do you guys thinking about AI and the use of identity to fake videos? Because one of the things Carter has is that you can sign a key for me if I go on a call, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Will that actually destroy that as a service?
I mean, in a sense. However, there are other things that you can do. You know, there's multiple types of authentication. The video call is a like who you are, you know, almost biometric type of authentication. And that's what AI is pretty much on the verge of destroying, the sort of believability that you can believe anything that you see or hear through an electronic device. But there's still the things like something that you know is another type of authentication. So if you have a secret, you know, some sort of word, passphrase, whatever, or the fact that, you know, we may just have a conversation with you to, you know, talk about things that only we would know about each other. You know, that's other ways of authenticating that, you know, you're not a North Korean hacker. So it is a constantly evolving landscape, though.
Do you also have keywords that are like, we know that you're being held against your will and doing this call?
Yeah. We definitely offer the ability to have duress words. We offer the ability to have other contacts, friends and family on file that will reach out to, you know, out of band for them to contact and authenticate. Mm-hmm. So it's about having multiple ways to authenticate that our clients are who they say they are.
And if you get on a call and someone uses one of those words, what do you actually do?
We then enact whatever protocol we've set up beforehand, which may be, you know, contacting the friends, family, law enforcement, so on.
Mm. Yeah, because you could put them at risk.
Yeah.
Further risk.
But that's a really tricky thing to navigate for you, because if it's like you need to sign a transaction which will allow them to spend their Bitcoin and you don't do it, you're also putting them at like additional physical risk potentially.
Well, you wouldn't use the duress word.
Yeah.
You also have to remember that there's time delays. We don't sign anything without at least multiple days of time delay.
Yeah.
Which the attacker will be told or learn in the process.
Yeah.
So it often will then come down to the sophistication, patience, intelligence of the attacker.
Mm-hmm.
Like a machete attack sounds like a...
That's an in and out.
Yeah.
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 Where somebody surveilled you for a period of time.
And has the trend on these physical attacks increased?
With the exchange rate, it tends to ebb and flow very similarly. Maybe a little bit of lag here and there. But
yeah.
Yeah. Another thing I've been thinking about is if you had, say you've migrated to the stage you're at multi-sig, you've got a Casa 305, but your net wealth has ballooned to like 100 million or something ridiculous. Are you an idiot to just have it all in one 305 multi-sig, even though it's pretty damn secure, but you haven't really distributed your money? And what do you think of these kind of like multi-jurisdiction custody solutions, where you're almost like offloading the keys to, you know, these other entities?
Yeah. So, you know, we have a mantra of diversify your keys, not your coins. There's a very common trope that we've seen. If people have a lot of Bitcoin and they're not into multi-sig, then they probably have like 10 ledgers and 10 trezors or whatever, and they have a little bit on each one. And here's the way I think about that. Yes, you are diversifying risk if you're putting them on different devices and throwing them all over the place. So you are correct in that you are decreasing the chance of a single failure being catastrophic. However, what I think a lot of people miss is that you're increasing the chance of having a small loss, because you have one or two failures and that results in, you know, some percentage of your funds being lost. So we are firm believers in having one well-constructed, well-architected, well-thought-out setup. It's is it a forget if it's a Henry Ford quote, but it's like, you know, they say don't put your eggs in one basket, right? But I think it was Henry Ford or someone similar said, no, actually, you should put all of your eggs in one basket and you should watch it very, very carefully. Like, that's how you know that they're going to be safe.
But you don't think maybe, I mean, say you had a billion, should you have five sets of 200 million multi-sigs?
You could, but right, you're increasing complexity. So it's just a matter of like how much complexity do you want to manage. Now, if you're at that level, you really should have a team of people who are managing the complexity for you. So it's certainly more feasible.
It's like a Bitcoin family office.
Yes. And look, we work with family offices. And multi-sig is great for family offices. You have multiple employees. Hopefully they're distributed and you can, you know, have multiple key managers. So you know, look, Michael Saylor doesn't manage his own keys and I don't expect him to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have been thinking about that, just even getting it away from being a thing I manage to somebody else. Like, that's possibly something you have to do 10, 20 years down the line. And then you have to think about inheritance. And a really interesting point of inheritance I've been thinking about a lot, there's actually two really important parts of inheritance. One, that when you die, your heirs can receive your Bitcoin. But two, are they capable of managing it?
Well, you got to start them young. You really can't have your family be ignorant of the generational wealth that you're building for them.
I lost my kids in a boat accident. Where should people go for additional resources on this?
My educational resources are at bitcoin.page. You can check out all of the offerings that CASA has at casa.io, C-A-S-A.io. And we've rolled out some pretty cool stuff just in the past few months. We rolled out what I believe is the easiest to use inheritance offering in existence. Basically, we have some encrypted key sharing where it's as simple as getting your beneficiaries to scan some QR codes back and forth with you so that they can be onboarded into your key set. And then there's some additional game theory around like how the actual inheritance process plays out with time locks and such.
It's like a 6-month thing, isn't it?
Correct.
Yeah.
And then we just announced a couple of days ago that we are the first ever to figure out how to secure Bitcoin private keys inside of a YubiKey. And a YubiKey it's generally an enterprise security device, just looks like a little USB dongle. And there are nearly 30 million of them in use around the world. It's a decade-old company that has been doing enterprise authentication and security for a long time, has a great reputation. And just because of some new technology, passkey technology, that is being pushed forward as a standard by both Google and Apple, and YubiKey just released a new version of their firmware that supports this, we figured out how to use that as an envelope for actually securely storing Bitcoin private keys.
And why would you use the YubiKey?
It's meant to be pushing some of the optionality of what our clients can do more towards the convenience spectrum.
Yeah.
Because
it's just easier than having a ledger.
You know how difficult ledgers and Trezors and cold cards are. Like these are generally devices, like they're built for nerds. And you know, I don't have any problem navigating using them, but the sort of average non-technical person can feel overwhelmed at the complexity of having a device where, you know, you have to manage the firmware updates on it. You know, sometimes things break from time to time, and it can be a lot of steps to actually go through the process of transacting, you know, signing partially signed Bitcoin transactions with them.
So how do you sign a transaction on a YubiKey?
Yeah, I mean, look, a YubiKey is just a little USB dongle with one button on it. So when you're signing a transaction on the CASA platform, it's as simple as, you know, plugging it into your laptop. You know, we still send you like the email link with a URL, and it loads up our site. And you have to realize that passkeys bind themselves to the domain. So it's basically phishing proof because it's only going to work on the CASA domain. And all you have to do is, you know, tap on the button when it asks you to authenticate.
Would you have that as, you know, if CASA have three or five, one's the mobile, one's you, would you have three YubiKeys, or is it like a YubiKey, a ledger, and a Trezor?
I as always, diversity, strength through diversity. And, you know, you can have the YubiKey as maybe one of your more common, easily accessible signers.
And it doesn't hold the private key of what was previously a ledger. It's its own private key.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. We should check that out. Lop, amazing. Also, go to lop.net. Loads of cool resources there. Appreciate you, man. From third interview to maybe the third from last.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.